Good morning. We're just about to start, and I wanted to point out first that actually we have slides starting off, so you picked the right place, or maybe we've learned. I'd like you to welcome you to this morning's breakout session, State Failures of Fragile Pakistan and Afghanistan. My name is Terry Vogt. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, and I work at a company called Terra Global Capital, and we do carbon credits. I must admit, I was also warned that this is not state-of-the-art microphones, so I will ask the rest of the people to speak more clearly and closely. Is this working now? Okay. The format for this morning's session will be short presentations by each of our speakers, followed by questions from the audience. You know the drill. Write the questions on the paper as they come around. They'll come up here, and I will then deal the questions out as at the end. Also reminding you, please turn off cell phones, beepers, the like. The Obama administration has engaged in a top-to-bottom review of American strategy in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Pragmatism appears to be the hallmark of its approach to these two troubled countries. This morning, we are pleased to welcome three experts who will discuss the range of problems the administration is confronting in this area and what prospects the future may hold. Our first speaker today is Stephen Krasner, who is the Graham H. Stewart Professor of International Relations at Stanford University. From 2005 to 2007, he served as the Director of Policy Planning at the U.S. State Department when he was a driving force behind reforming U.S. foreign assistance. Our second speaker will be Neil Jock. Dr. Jock is Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Security Research at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and an Adjunct Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley. From 2004 to 2005, Neil Jock served as Director for Counterproliferation Strategy at the National Security Council, where he was responsible for India and Pakistan proliferation issues. Our third speaker this morning is William Cole, Senior Director for Governance, Law, and Civil Society Programs at the Asia Foundation, where he is responsible for coordinating programs on democratic governance, the rule of law, and conflict management. Please join me in welcoming our speakers. And Stephen, it's yours.
Thank you very much. I want to confess at the outset that this presentation is something of an indulgence. It's what you can do as an academic, because I'm going to explain why, in general terms, why Afghanistan and Pakistan are such incredibly challenging problems, and I don't have very much to say about solutions. But my two colleagues, this is something you can never do in government, where you have to say what you're actually going to do and not go and tell your boss that something's very difficult. But my two colleagues on the panel are much more knowledgeable about Afghanistan and Pakistan than I am. So what I want to do is sort of provide a general setting about why fixing failed states is such a difficult problem. This is a quote from a 2004 book by Francis Fukuyama called State Building, an excellent book which I recommend, in which he says, how to promote governance of weak states, improve their democratic legitimacy, and strengthen self-sustaining institutions thus become the central project of contemporary international politics. All right, here's a way of putting this issue in some context. When I taught, I teach the introductory international relations course at Stanford, and basically at any point before 1990, this is what international politics looked like. It was about state-to-state relations. What were the relations between the Soviet Union and the United States, or between Germany and France before the First and Second World Wars? And we still do have issues like this in the international environment, like American relations with China, in which if I ask you, which I won't, what should our policy be towards China, People have very direct, concrete answers, and they are engagement or containment. That's all that ever happens when you ask an audience. And the debate and kind of contours of the debate are very clear. Right, there's a second set of issues in international politics about foreign policy, which have to do with how do the domestic institutions and values in different countries affect the way in which they conduct their foreign policy. To what extent did American values, for instance, influence the Bush administration's focus on the promotion of democracy in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere? And we actually have some decent understanding, analytic understanding of this problem. The third problem is state building. State building has to do with something we never talked about in international politics before 1990. And although we talk about it now, I would say we have very limited systematic knowledge. State building has to do with how does one state influence domestic authority structures and values in another state. We are not just trying to change the policies of Afghanistan. We're trying to change domestic institutions and political structures in Pakistan. And I will tell you, both in the government and academia, we know very, very little about this. There's not even a systematic academic debate in which I could say, here's theory A and here's theory B and here's the evidence for them. So it's dramatically different than the situation if you're thinking about international politics or foreign policy. All right, what I want to do is look at what I think are the three big theories of state development over historically, thinking about what have people said about the way in which states have gotten to be the way in which they are, without necessarily thinking about the role of external actors. All right, the most famous and popular theory, I would say, is modernization theory, which is pretty familiar to everyone. And basically, modernization theory says that democracy and political development are associated with economic development, more education, urbanization, a larger middle class. The middle class is more tolerant and has a longer time horizon. So it basically says if you get rich, you're going to get democratic. And there are lots of arguments now, for instance, about China along exactly these lines. China continues to get richer, it'll transition into a normal democratic state. Everything will be terrific. This is a trajectory, if you think about the trajectory of this theory, which is unidirectional and up. You get on the bottom of the escalator and you end up at Denmark, like the best governed state in the world. And maybe there's a little bumps and rattles in the middle, but, you know, it's really not that bad. You'll get there if you can just get economic growth going. Policy implications of this theory, which I would say are still the major kind of policy implications if you're looking at foreign assistance over the last 50 or 60 years, are basically provide more resources. So if you think about this international goal, aim, whatever it is, that industrialized countries should give 0.7% of their GDP as foreign assistance, it in some ways reflects this theory. It says problem in developing countries is that there's a finance gap. Foreign aid provides additional finance. We'll be able to have economic growth. If we have economic growth, we'll have democratic development. It also says support the Millennium Development Goals. If you've read any of Jeff Sachs's stuff, this is his leitmotif throughout. Second theory, institutional capacity. In 1968, Samuel Huntington, who died very recently, published a book called Political Development and Changing Societies, which for many people in political science demolished modernization theory. What Huntington said was political mobilization without institutionalization leads to political underdevelopment. You get a lot of people concentrated in cities with higher levels of education, you're not going to get growth, you're just going to get riots, unless you have adequate political institutionalization. Fukuyama, in this 2004 book, makes, I think, a very insightful argument in which he says that the problem with many states in the developing world today is that they have a very wide scope of state authority. They're supposed to do everything that Denmark is doing. They're supposed to have a social security system. They're supposed to provide free education for everybody. They're supposed to have a healthcare system. All these countries actually have national science foundations, even countries with no scientists. So they had a template that they got from Europe or the United States. These countries became independent around 1960. You took that template, you plopped it down in Africa, in a situation where these countries had, at a minimum, not the resources to carry them out. All right, from this perspective, this idea of institutional capacity, The trajectory is there's no guarantee of development. You can get on the escalator at Rhodesia and end up in Mugabe. And it depends entirely on whether or not you can develop institutional capacity. The policy implications of this theory are build state capacity, and this means things like training, technical assistance. You see a lot of the talk by the U.S. military about what you're doing in Afghanistan, for instance, is how many men have we trained for the army? What's the level of police training? Same thing in Iraq. The story is a story about state capacity. When Huntington made his argument originally, he actually argued what you needed were one-party states. All right, so modernization, state building, and institutional capacity, those are two very different theories. Third theory, a little more complicated, basically says that state building and state development are the result of bargaining among elites. Political, and here's an argument which is coming from a new book by one of my colleagues, Barry Weingast. It's a great book, just out from Cambridge University Press, in which he makes the following argument. He says if you look at all of human history, at least for the last 10,000 years, there have basically been two kinds of societies. There have been what he calls open access societies, and there have been closed access societies. Open access societies are societies in which everybody has a right to make a deal. Everybody has a right to form an organization. If you want to start a business in the United States, it takes about 2 days. For instance, if anyone here, you could sit and list all the organizations that you belong to. In closed access societies, the right to form organizations, to have access to the rule of law, to have access to a court system, to be able to rely on some kind of force to keep order, is limited to a small percentage of the elite. All right, the question is, if you look, the argument that Weingast makes is that if you look at all of human history, you've only had open access societies for maybe the last 150 years, and there are only a couple of dozen of them in the world now. How do you get to open access societies? What Weingast argues is that you need in these closed access societies to get to some level of rule of law. You need to have what he calls perpetual organizations, that is, organizations that can live forever. And you need central government control of the military. And if you reach those points, which are things that maybe Britain and France reach around 1900, you may then be able to move towards an open access society, which is what you need for long-term growth, development, and democracy. The trajectory from this perspective is there is no guarantee of development. You can get on the escalator at Rome and end up in the Dark Ages. Or you can get on the escalator in Britain in 1688 at the Glorious Revolution and get off at the United States, which is pretty good. This is a much more random process, haphazard, depends a lot on luck and particular historical circumstances. The policy implications are you need to offer incentives to external actors, and you need to be opportunistic if you're an external actor trying to engage in state building. What I will say is this. If you look at most American foreign assistance and you look at policies towards Pakistan and Afghanistan, they're driven primarily by an underlying assumptions which either rely on institutional capacity or modernization theory. If, in fact, bargaining and elite deals are really the theory that works, it is very, very hard for governments to carry out policies like this. Be opportunistic. Is not a prescription for the State Department or AID or the Department of Defense, even though there are moments like the alliance with the Sunni Awakening in which opportunism proves to be extremely effective.
Thank you, Stephen Krasner. We're going to change the order here and hear next from William Cole from the Asia Foundation. Wait, Bill?
Hey, thanks, Terry. Over the next few minutes, what I want to do is focus my remarks, moving it down a level to focus on Afghanistan, and I'll do that in the context of the Obama administration's just-out strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And then I want to, if there's any time left, I'll end up with some observations on assisting U.S. assistance to failed and failing states. So what's the situation in Afghanistan right now? First, it's important to recognize that the Afghans and the international community have made progress. There's an awful lot of focus on the downside of what's been happening, and they've been making it. That progress has been made with a lot of sacrifice and a lot of investment on the part of individuals and communities and states. However, we all know the downsides. Most of the central state institutions in Afghanistan are weak, capacity is low. The capacity is low and state administration is minimal in many parts of the country. Corruption is rampant and reportedly worsening. Poppy and opium production may be declining, but is still high, and there's been a failure to develop a sustainable, legitimate economy. Levels of personal insecurity are rising. The Karzai administration is extremely unpopular, and the country may be facing an electoral crisis over the next month or two. In general, the whole state building project in Afghanistan has turned out to be much more difficult than was initially expected. U.S. goals in Afghanistan have been unclear. Are we in this to deny a base to global jihadis, a base from which they would attack us? Are we in this to develop a thriving, modern, democratic Afghanistan? And most problematic of all, the Taliban insurrection with its bases in Pakistan has been growing in strength, particularly since 2005, and if left unchecked, it could threaten all of the advances that we've made so far. As a frequent traveler in Afghanistan and Pakistan, I can tell you that the mood has changed dramatically over the last couple of years. So what's the Obama administration's plan? Well, first off, there's the surge in American troops, eventually up to 60,000, and that has already begun. But there's a wide, I think, recognition. There has been a wide recognition that a much more thoroughgoing revision of U.S. policy and a renewed commitment has been necessary. That new strategy and commitment was announced last Friday by the White House and issued the White Paper on U.S. policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And there are both new directions and a reemphasis on our long-term commitment in this part of the world in that document. From my perspective, probably the most important, the most significant advance is right in the title, and that's the recognition that Pakistan and Afghanistan, the problems that we face in Pakistan and Afghanistan, are really aspects of a single complex problem. Defeat of the Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan will be very difficult or impossible as long as the safe havens in Pakistan remain. The White Paper does provide a degree of clarity on our goals and objectives. Our core goal is now to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat the extremists and their safe havens in Pakistan. That's a much clearer perspective than we have had in the past. But there's no retreat at all from the far more costly and difficult task of state building. State building is seen as essential for achieving that security goal. At least in theory, there could have been a shift down to a much tighter and more limited goal, and that did not happen. The new policy embraces the need to plan and execute an effective civilian-military counterinsurgency strategy. This is a break from earlier years when a much more conventional military strategy was pursued. The elements of a classic counterinsurgency strategy are, of course, to separate local population from insurgents, win the people over by addressing their needs and grievances, degrade warfighting and propaganda capacity of the insurgents, and to do all of this under primarily civilian leadership. All other elements of the new strategy support this new counterinsurgency focus. And, of course, we have General Petraeus fresh out of Iraq with his counterinsurgency skills on the job now. On the security side, there'll be a massive buildup of the Afghan National Army and police. We're already at 80,000, which is a huge it's taken years to get to 80,000 ANA troops, Afghan National Army troops, and that's going to rise over the next 2 years by over 50% to 124,000. And the target is for 80,000 police. That's a huge investment and a big task ahead, but absolutely critical. There's a renewed commitment to state building, particularly at the subnational level. The lack of progress to date is partly because security is so bad, but it's partly because there are so many actors who have been very uncoordinated in the past. There's also, at the local level, the PRTs, the international community PRTs, particularly the U.S. PRTs. These are slated for a shift to a strategy which looks more like the PRTs in Afghanistan, in Iraq.
Define PRT.
The PRTs are the outposts, the military and civilian development outposts that are scattered around Afghanistan, and are there not to provide security for the population, but to do development activities, to put a presence, international presence, in those areas. But that shift will be from a primarily military focus to many more civilians in those PRTs. I think one of the most important new directions is the plan to attempt to entice the less extreme Taliban groups away from the core insurgent leadership, and that's an ambitious plan. The idea of splitting the Taliban from Al-Qaeda, but one that's absolutely essential to the overall strategy, because you can't put enough troops in to win this without seriously dropping the numbers of people committed to the insurgency. At the same time, some of the conditions that are being imposed from the outset make me a little bit skeptical. Compromises may have to be made by the Afghanistan government and the international community with the Taliban, compromises that currently are being explicitly rejected. We talk a little bit about those in the discussion, if you like. The troop surge is absolutely critical to this. You can't coax significant numbers of insurgents into talks as long as they think they're winning the war, which would be the general view from the ground at this point. New strategy recognizes the importance of breaking the link between the narcotics trade and the insurgency. Finally, the white paper underscores the need for a wide-ranging diplomatic strategy to support all these efforts. Part of that will be an effort to bring in regional players, most strikingly Iran. And Iran has taken part in the Hague Conference that has just taken place. And that is a real change. So, what are the prospects for success? Can we strengthen the core capabilities of the state along the lines that Steve Krasner was just talking about? When you consider where we started in 2001, as I said before, with virtually nothing, the capacities of the Afghan state, as weak as they are pretty impressive, pretty remarkable. But on the whole, state building. Building effective and responsive state institutions anywhere, much less in Afghanistan, is much, much harder than is generally recognized. And the progress is not going to be fast. On the corruption issue, this is a problem that's getting a lot of attention in the press, in policy circles. Corruption is rapidly eroding the legitimacy of the Afghan state, and it's helped to drive President Karzai's ratings through the floor. Still, for my part, I think that significant progress on this problem is unlikely. With institutions this weak, with this level of temptation, this level of resources floating around, both from the drug trade and the donor assistance, it seems to me that corruption on an absolutely massive scale was almost inevitable, basically inevitable. The president's family is so involved in this shouldn't surprise us. This happens in almost every country that has anything like these kinds of conditions. Bottom line on state building, progress will continue to be made. It'll be much slower than what's needed for an effective counterinsurgency strategy. Expansion of subnational capacities won't take place in the more volatile regions, and corruption won't be addressed, as I say, in the medium term. I think the greatest challenge ahead is for the success of the new Obama strategy, which is fully recognized in the strategy itself, is the problem of insurgents, safe havens in Pakistan. Today, a loose network of Islamic militants operate with relative freedom in a wide strip of territory that runs all along the Pakistan side of the border, from Balochistan through Fatah, through Swat Valley now, and up into Pakistani Kashmir. the rise of homegrown and militants focusing on Pakistan, on destabilizing Pakistan, has been a dramatic development over the last couple of years, and these guys now really seriously threaten stability in Pakistan over the next few years. It's in those really tough mountainous areas that these bases are located, and it's going to be almost impossible to root that out over the next couple of years. The Pakistan needs to commit to a full-scale counterinsurgency effort, but that's unlikely as long as they're focused on India as the primary national security threat to Pakistan. In fact, the militants are seen as a manageable problem, not just as a manageable problem. They're seen as one of the force multipliers against India. So it's very hard to make that shift in Pakistan. We're not likely to see a change there. In conclusion, I think the administration's new strategy is a great step forward. I think there are problems that need to be addressed, but and we need to be patient in how slow the progress is going to be in Afghanistan. Most important, though, the outcome in Afghanistan, and I've said this at several points in these remarks, the outcome in Afghanistan is going to be dependent on what happens in Pakistan concerning its own internal insurgency, its own militants. And the international community has very limited levers to pull in that regard. I hate to end with a down-pointing perspective. And in an organization that's really focused on the Asia Foundation, focused on developing on progress in Afghanistan and Pakistan, we have to stay at it. But the next few years could be a very, very rough ride for the United States and the international community.
Thank you, Bill Cole. We'll now turn to Neil Jock, senior fellow of the Center for Global Security Research at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory.
Thank you very much, Terry. The division of responsibilities fell rather naturally to the three of us, with Steve giving you the broader picture of what state building looks like from a political perspective, and then Bill looking at Afghanistan. So now let's take a little bit of a look at Pakistan and some of the problems we see with Pakistan. Before getting into it, I'd like to note that the program called for us to think about how we might anticipate state failure, how we might then try to avert state failure, and then how we respond to it. And to some extent, Steve's description of the three theories captures how we might anticipate it. The problem then is how you avert it. And inherently, we run into the problem, an area that Steve is one of the world's experts on, having to do with sovereignty and states that ultimately are responsible for their own output, their own people. And Pakistan is a case in point. Finally, we're left in many cases, and especially with Pakistan and Afghanistan now, of trying to respond constructively to a breakdown in order. Well, what is a failed state? I think of it in terms of a condition where the institutions of the central state are so weakened that they cannot maintain authority or political order outside the capital city. Well, we certainly see that in Pakistan and Afghanistan, but one of the problems I have with the concept of a failed state is that it does apply to many states at different points in their existence. So it's not a very necessarily very helpful concept to help us understand the problems we face in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. One scholar, William Zartman, has called state collapse as a long-term degenerative disease. So it's not something that is easy to intercede with and solve easily. What are the factors then that contribute to the weakness of Pakistan? Pakistan faces enormous economic challenges. A primary problem they face is the simple issue of tax collection. They have not had an agricultural tax in their history, and as an essentially agricultural society, a large source of revenues goes unaccessed. Pakistan is also facing the very serious problems of corruption as well as a debt burden that they have a hard time handling. So the economic challenges are significant for Pakistan. Political decline is also a continuing problem, where you have weak parties and party decay. You have leaders who frequently have tended to demonize the parties that are out of power rather than to build the society. And also you have continually in Pakistan's history had the intervention of the military that has gotten in the way of political development, of the development of democracy, but continues to be a problem in that the military sees itself as the only institution that's capable of maintaining order and preventing state failure. Another factor that contributes to the weakness of Pakistan is ethnic divisions. It's a country that's composed of different ethnic groups, but it's dominated by the Punjabis in both the military and in the bureaucracy. At the same time, you have the identity of the Pashtuns, and this underlies the problem between Pakistan and Afghanistan, where the Pashtun identity rises up, as we see, as Bill described in the Fatah and in the Northwest Frontier area. There's also the issue of religious sectarianism, where you have Islamic parties contesting for power, not particularly effectively, but nonetheless they continue to be a part of contributing to the fissiparous tendencies in Pakistan. You also have a Sunni versus Shia problem in that there's continue to be both elements of Islamic sects within Pakistan, and they contribute to religious problems. And of course, the more fundamental is the Taliban's influence, the Taliban bleeding over from Afghanistan since 2001, but prior to that actually being a product of Pakistan's support. There's also a certain amount of social incoherence in that Pakistan still has an essentially feudal structure, has declining literacy rates. Madrasa schools that have replaced the public state-supported schools. Institutional vulnerability is also a problem for Pakistan in that their institutions have not been well-developed, and some will say that's because the military keeps intervening and preventing them from maturing. We're left also with the last point of military cohesion. If the military is the only organization within Pakistan that sees the state as the highest good and endeavors to sustain the state, what about the internal problems with the military, with respect to politicization of the military, with respect to the different divisions of the military, such as the ISID, the intelligence division of the army, as well as potential impact of Islamic thinking within Pakistan, within the military? So we have this large list of problems that Pakistan faces. Why do we care if it collapses? Well, the main concern we have with Pakistan is the issue of loose nuclear weapons. The vision of when the Soviet Union broke apart, and there was great concern that as it broke apart, there would be lack of central control over their nuclear stockpile. This image concerns many in the West. It certainly concerns Pakistanis as well, and they've done quite a bit to ensure that the military has good control over their weapons. But in the event of a state breakdown, would we then face access to the nuclear stockpile? There are other reasons we're concerned: historic friendship with Pakistan, humanitarian reasons. There would be big power competition in this area if Pakistan were to break down, and so on. But the primary concern, I think, is with loose nukes. Why do we care if Afghanistan collapses? Well, the main concern, of course, was made evident in 2001, that it would again become a terrorist haven, a place where terrorists who wish us ill would be able to safely organize and plan attacks. I think there's also a point that we need to consider with respect to the concerns on Afghanistan, and that is the NATO factor. I think many people are concerned about the effect of failure in Afghanistan on NATO. NATO has taken this on as a alliance war, and if we fail, I think the negative impact blowback within NATO would be significant. Also in Afghanistan, there are humanitarian issues. There would be a huge boost for the fundamentalist approach within Islam that would make it much harder for moderates within the Islamic world to prevail, which I think is an important trend that we would like to avoid. We want to see, and I think the bulk of the Islamic world is moderate, but success for radical views of Islam and radical interpretations of Islam, if that were to succeed in Afghanistan, it would be very bad more generally. Well, let me go back to Pakistan and just say, when we talk about the loose nukes issue, what is it that we are concerned about, and therefore what steps would we like to take perhaps to avert this? The key elements of a loose nuke scenario are that the people who are involved in the program would then be, in a sense, detached and would be available, you could say, for work and support in other areas, whether that might be North Korea, Iran, other potential proliferators. There's the issue just of the fissile material, the basic highly enriched uranium that Pakistan has produced that is used for their nuclear weapons. We don't want to see fissile material afloat in the world. It doesn't take very large quantity of highly enriched uranium to make a bomb, and so we would worry about in the breakdown of the state that this would go missing. There's also the equipment to produce the fissile material, which the international nonproliferation regime is sought to avoid being transferred. That, too, would be more available. Other controlled equipment, as well as the nuclear design know-how, would become more readily available, more distributed around the world. We want to make sure that that is avoided, too. So there are a number of steps that we take on an ongoing basis through nuclear nonproliferation activities to prevent this spread of nuclear technology and to prevent the transfer of nuclear capability from Pakistan elsewhere. But in the event that the negative trends in Pakistan were to flower, if you will, our concerns would be greatly enhanced, greatly increased. So what steps can we take, finally, to both anticipate, avert, and then reverse? Well, state building clearly is the first two, I think, of what two theories that Steve mentioned are clearly part of the new Pakistan-Afghanistan plan. That is both to help modernize both in Pakistan and Afghanistan through the provision of aid. And also, with respect to institution building, there's a great emphasis on capacity building. Hopefully, this will avert the breakdown of either state. But as I said at the beginning, this is a long-term degenerative disease, and so the point is that we can take steps to try to ameliorate the effects of slow but steady breakdown within both states. Ultimately, however, we're faced with the problem of creating security where there is none, that a lot of this can't happen without the security forces in both states being able to extend the writ of the state to all parts of the country. And a key element that is very hard to get to come to grips with that continues to undermine a state's ability to enforce central control is the fact of civil war. Pakistan does not face a civil war, but Afghanistan certainly does. And until we are able to deal with the fact of civil war in Afghanistan, in effect a war that has been going on since the Soviet invasion in 1979, we will face significant challenges to being able to reverse and stabilize all of these tendencies to break down both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. At that point, let me stop, and we're now looking forward to questions and a conversation with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil John. Thank you. A round for everybody, please. As usual, with this well-informed audience, there are a variety of very good questions. I'd like to say that they fall into two major areas. One is sort of asking for clarification on the current system or maybe on the historical perspective. The second is sort of tactics and problems and leading towards solutions. And it occurred to me I wanted to throw out a first question, one of the few prerogatives that a moderator has, and to think back to the overriding question that we returned to in the plenary, which was saying, well, given the financial crisis, how does our current world economic and financial crisis impact on state building and on the question of Afghanistan and Pakistan? And sort of secondly, can we really take all this on? I mean, how are we going to be able to make some hard choices there? And I start with Stephen, since he spoke first, and ask you about, is there a link between finance and the crisis and what we need to do in state building today?
You know, I'm tempted to say, I know from long experience that you should sound authoritative when you're answering these questions, but I could exchange my place with any random person in the audience and have the same level of knowledge. Let me say two things. One is, you know, the fact is that know, if you look at government share, and this is a relatively familiar argument, if you look at government share of GDP now, or our spending on defense compared to what it was in the 1960s and 70s, you know, much less compared to what it was in World War II, it's very modest. It's 3 or 4%, you know, compared to 10%, compared to 50% during the Second World War. So is there some, you know, could we commit the resources? I think probably yes. I think the real question, which is a deeper one, is this. You know, we're now, you know, quite a eight years past 9/11. How serious a threat is this? And I think the real problem, the real challenge is that if we think about if it weren't for transnational terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, we would not care. We wouldn't care any more what's going on in Afghanistan than we cared about what was going on in Rwanda. That's the truth. And the problem is, how does the government deal with a situation in which you have the small probability of a very bad thing happening? Requires taking out an insurance policy, and it may be more difficult to take out an insurance policy in the current economic environment. So it's not that I think the United States can't do this in terms of its material resources, but it may be that the political support for continued engagement in Afghanistan may wane over time, but could, of course, be revived dramatically and very quickly if we have another mega terrorist attack.
Thank you. Bill, do you have a?
Go ahead.
Well, can we afford it? It's interesting to see that before the election, there was what was called the Biden plan that came out of Congress, and then Senator Joe Biden said that the investment of $10 billion in Pakistan since September 11, 2001 was not well spent, that it was too much of a blank check. But his solution was not at that time to say we should stop giving money. Rather, it was to say we should give more. And he proposed that we increase spending in Pakistan to $1.5 billion per year for 10 years. But this time, we should be much more careful about how it's spent. That is, we should, in a certain sense, ask for a receipt for how the money is spent. Well, this now, in the recently announced Obama plan, has, with Mr. Biden now as the vice president, taken on life as policy rather than a proposal from the Senate. And the only difference is that the amount of time, the time commitment is reduced to 5 years rather than 10 years. So the U.S. is now committing $1.5 billion a year to Pakistan for all of the kinds of things that Steve enumerated with respect to the modernization as well as the institutional capacity building models for development. How successful we will be, that will be, remains to be seen. But when we look at that in relation to overall fiscal challenges that are addressed both in the stimulus package and overall expenses, that in a sense is a relatively small amount. So I think, in fact, we can do it.
Thank you. Bill.
Two quick points. First, the other speakers have talked about the whether we can handle this on the whole, I think and the effect on the whole. I think if we look domestically in a country like Pakistan, the financial crisis has had a huge impact. You've got much more stress on that population, many more people out of work. The garment industry, which is the backbone of the economy, has taken a huge hit from the crisis. The car parts industry, which was one of the major rising export industries, is virtually going to be wiped out, is what I'm told by Pakistani economists. So the stress on those populations is going to be high. If you look at the fact that out of 16 developing countries across South and Southeast Asia, 11 of them have either insurgencies or violent conflict going on at some point somewhere in the country. The potential for complicating the problem of state building in those areas and dealing with insurgencies or local violence rises. The second point, though, I want to make is that a lot of the thinking, I think that at this point there's a huge plate that the administration has. There are a lot of costs that are going on that we heard once again this morning, that a lot of investments need to be made. This is a huge debt that we're taking on. All of this may be manageable. One of the problems is when we think about what happens going forward in a place like Afghanistan and Pakistan, And we begin to make plans like the administration strategy. Those strategies are inherently linear. You make assumptions about if you do this, this will be the outcome. You need to sequence it in a certain way, make certain kinds of investments. The problem is there's a very high probability of unexpected events happening over the next couple or 3 years that would lead to a very nonlinear situation. Let me just give three right off the bat. We are attacked out of Fatah by al-Qaeda, Fatah, the federally administrated tribal areas that that Pakistan doesn't really control. We're attacked out of that area from al-Qaeda bases, maybe on nuclear plants. The administration, any American administration, has to then go in and clean out those bases. That absolutely throws the Islamic world, the Muslim world, into a turmoil and greatly increases our cost and the problems for the administration. Another possibility. Somebody gets a hold of five Stingers, takes down five passenger jets in the Midwest. Small thing, not that hard to accomplish. Nobody gets on a jet in the United States for the next year, and our economy takes a huge hit just from that event. The third one, which goes to the things that Neil talks about, a small tactical nuke goes off, and these guys get a hold of a small tactical, low probability, but a horrendous outcome. Small tactical nuke goes off in New York or Washington. The economic impact of that would be just devastating. So there are many more of these possibilities, and any one of them is low probability. All put all together, I see this as over the next few years, not unlikely that we will see some things that are real game changers and that throw the current ability to plan and think through, which is really critical and really good, what the administration is doing, very good. But all plans may have to be changed in just a few years, and we may go into greater debt with more stress and strain on the administration, a much bigger plate than we've got now. That could easily happen.
I'm not sure I should say thank you for that. But, it occurs to me that I really hope that we've got some good scenario planning going on this type of activity, both for prevention and response. Actually, this leads to another area, which is the question of how we are engaging our allies. In particular, two have come up several times in the questions. Two, broadly speaking. One, the whole European and NATO engagement in this part of the world. And the second, the role of India. And is there a growing role for India? And I would wonder, two of you, if you'd like to start off. I'm not sure who wants to take that first.
NATO, I think I said what I could in my presentation. That is, I hope there's no buyer's remorse with our NATO allies that they invoke the article that said an attack on any one is an attack on all after the September 11 attack. But certainly we're seeing strains in NATO as a consequence of the way the war has been fought, with some states, and I cite Canada in particular, taking a fairly heavy burden of fighting down in the southern and eastern provinces, and then some of the other states being somewhat more reluctant to have their soldiers engage in battle. So there's a real problem with respect to alliance cohesion and alliance management in how we conduct the operations, and a failure to successfully conclude the war in Afghanistan, I think, will have very negative consequences for NATO. With respect to India is a critical ally. I think the prior administration and going back to the Clinton administration got things right with respect to the relationship between the United States and India. India is an important emerging power. It's a longtime friend to the United States in many regards. And so the proliferation barriers that prevented the U.S. and India from growing closer were removed by the prior administration. And I think this administration, the Obama team, will basically follow that forward. Whether or not the new and strong relationship between the U.S. and India will translate into India being able to play a constructive role in terms of the war in Afghanistan, I think is problematic. I think the Indians are prepared to do what they can, and they are engaged in Afghanistan with respect to road building, hospital building, and so on, to try and help Afghanistan. But a lot of that is seen by, one might say, paranoid thinking in Pakistan as an effort by India to surround Pakistan. As Bill said, Pakistan continues to see its primary threat, most Pakistanis continue to see its primary threat as India. And to the extent that India is, quote unquote, helpful in Afghanistan, they will interpret that as a flanking effort by India to surround Pakistan, to complicate Pakistan's defense interests, and redouble Pakistan's support for those either within the Taliban or within groups in Afghanistan that would like to seize control of the state and push India back out. So that's a fraught issue, but nonetheless one that, based on our stronger relationship with India, we need to think through very carefully, and I'm sure that's being done.
Bill?
Well, I think Neil covered it well. The only thing I would add maybe is that if the critical problem for the United States in Afghanistan is whether Pakistan shifts away from its focus on India to dealing with its own militants, and if that's the critical thing for us, and the Pakistanis continue to focus on India because they're for both irrational and rational reasons. I mean, after all, India did help split Pakistan off and lost Bangladesh. But if that's the case, then what India does vis-a-vis Pakistan, in terms of forbearance, there are going to be a future attacks out of Pakistan, maybe as bad as Mumbai. What India does in terms of Indian leadership resisting its own popular demands for retaliation, what India does matters tremendously. I don't know how much leverage the United States has in that game, but India's actions over the next few years will be absolutely critical for us in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bill. Several people have also brought up the question of corruption in these states and whether there is the state building can really effectively deal with that question. Would someone just sort of quickly give a thumbnail back on the corruption issue in state building in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Without defending corruption, let me try to give some sense for the problem of corruption. And I think this is throughout the world, wherever corruption rears its head. Steve talked about the problems of state building and institutional development and modernization and so on. Corruption's a problem when a member of a family, and we need to think in terms of extended families as well, a member of a family, for one reason or another, gains a position that allows him access to resources. Now, that person may want to remain clean in the sense that he does not want to use his position for ill-gotten gains. He does not want to be corrupt. That said, he may be the only one in the extended family who has access to resources. And therefore, because of family obligation or a sense of responsibility to those who do not have the good luck he or she had, they are drawn into behaving in a corrupt fashion, even though they recognize that it's not in their interest. It's not just the case that you have perhaps what we could call the corruption that we've seen on Wall Street, where it's people wanting to get hundreds of millions of dollars so that they can buy yachts. It's people who are in a position to access resources of the state. It's not so that they can buy yachts. It's so that they can help provide for their extended family. Now, all of that said, people who are corrupt understand that this is not the best way to build the society. But it is a kind of short circuit or a shortcut to provisions for their families and others that is very, very hard to resist. So I don't want to be too moralistic about condemning corruption. It is wrong, and the people who are corrupt in these societies accept that it's wrong. That said, their great desire not to be corrupt is sometimes undermined by this sense of responsibility to a larger community.
Thank you. There are also some questions that are asking, is there a moderate Taliban? Is the Taliban the same between both the countries we're talking about? And then also questions addressing the cultural and tribal aspects that are inherent here. Bill, I think you may want this.
The Taliban really, General Barnhart, I just heard describe a few weeks ago, described the three different kinds of Taliban, three different groups. Think of it as three different groups. There's the core leadership under Mullah Omar and their gendarmes around them. They're mostly based in Quetta in Balochistan. That's the absolute core, and there's no negotiating with them. They're not global jihadis, and there are conflicts between them and Al-Qaeda. But they are jihadis in the context of Afghanistan, and there is no negotiating there. Second group are mostly in Afghanistan, Pashtun tribal elements, tribal groups, who look at the way the war is going. And the Afghans, if anything, are extremely pragmatic. And they look at they look at where things are going, and they're simply going to place bets on which side is likely to win. It looks like the Karzai administration and the government are in major trouble. And before we were talking about a surge, the bets tended to go in the direction of the Taliban. So that's a second group of Taliban. That group, because it's not ideological, it's pragmatic. Elements of them can be brought over. The third group are what are sometimes called Afghans for hire. These are the youth, and the youth is the problem in much of the world. They're the hope and the problem. Young men with guns, and they're hireable to fight. It's partly ideological. It's partly, but it's largely pragmatic. That group, unfortunately, many of those people are paid more than Afghan National Army recruits. But as long as that funding's there, and there's going to be a problem. So, can they be split? Maybe, but it has to be done very, very, very wisely. And it's not clear that we can get that many enough in to make a big difference in terms of numbers. That's going to be one of the big challenges going forward. What's really striking is that the administration, that the U.S. government has now embraced that component of a strategy, which wasn't the case before.
Thank you. If I could just add one point, we do have a point of reference in Iraq, and that is that when the Provisional Authority took power after the military victory in Iraq, a decision was made to disband the Ba'athist Party. And I think on balance, we can see now that that was probably not the best way to create the conditions for constructing a post-occupation Iraq. And we probably need to consider that lesson that we can identify from Iraq and consider how best to apply that in Afghanistan. We're not there as an occupying power. We're there in response to an attack that took place on the United States soil, and we want to respond to that and ensure that it doesn't happen again. But we want to leave Afghanistan, and what we want to leave behind is a functioning state. If that includes those who, as Bill, I think, correctly identified from General Barno, include people who were nominally part of the Taliban before, we ought to keep an open mind about that. At the same time, we can't fool ourselves into thinking that the leadership of the Taliban is reconcilable. And it's very difficult to negotiate with the foot soldiers. You have to negotiate or confront those who are in the leadership. And I think we ought not to fool ourselves about the leadership being amenable to some sort of coalition government, that they would respect the positions of those who are now in authority in Kabul. I think we would be fooling ourselves to think that someone like Mullah Omar or Gulbuddin Hekmatyar are able to, who are interested in anything more than absolute control in a post-war Afghanistan.
Thank you. It occurs to me right now that we learned something about Lord Kelvin in our first addresses, which is the importance of being able to measure things. So I'd like to ask each of you to give me two things that you look at daily and would then show you what are the measurements, factors you're looking at to be able to say in 4 years, 5 years, that we have succeeded or failed, and or the sense of progress. Stephen, pick it up.
Yeah, since I'm not in the government anymore, I don't look at anything daily. But let me say, I think that's exactly the wrong way to look at it, because it implies that there's a kind of linear pattern of development in which if we can get things right and we'll just go up, we'll be okay. I think Bill's much more accurate in saying, I mean, there are all kinds of potential game changers. So I think it's actually a mistake to look at, you know, daily indicators, which isn't to say that we just have to be wandering out there in the wilderness, but I think we need to be flexible in what we're examining. And the measures may change over time.
one of the reasons I ask is, and it's come up on some questions, is that's the way people expect to have things happen. So clearly we think more linearly or than we do sort of broadly and systemically. So go ahead.
Yeah. Steve and I worked together in the prior administration. We were both together in the policy planning, on the policy planning staff for a period of time, and I think we share certain views. In a sense, the Bush administration said, we are not looking for body counts with Pakistan in order to justify the amount of money we're giving to them. And looking for these daily indicators is very problematic. We're now in a new administration, and for many in the new administration, they'll say, yeah, well, that's great. How'd that work out for you guys? Not so hot. So 8 years after you were in power, we're left with a pretty tacky situation. So how are we going to fix it? And so one of the ways that they're addressing it is, in fact, not necessarily to look at daily indicators, but to have some measures of success. Probably not very good, but a couple that they're pointing to are how many Afghan National Army recruits are trained and put in the field, and how many Afghan National Police are trained and put in the field. That's going to be a metric that they're going to address and say, that tells us we're having success. Of course, the real measure of success will be whether or not those police and troops, once they're in the field, can actually sustain security after a region has been controlled. Another measure that they're going to be looking at is poppy production and whether or not poppy production goes down. This, again, will be an indicator that this administration, I think, will look to say, are we being successful in reversing the source of funding for the insurrection, for the violence that's going on? If we can eliminate poppy production, therefore, presumably, the financial support that is gained from poppy production that goes to the Taliban will be undercut. I share Steve's view that looking for these, sort of the functional equivalent of body counts isn't necessarily the best way to measure success. But that said, the administration that we previously worked for has a hard time making the case that we were very successful by not doing that.
Thanks. Bill, do you want to?
Just last point. If part of an effective counterinsurgency strategy is to win the population over, then popular attitudes are popular views of the government and the state are absolutely critical. My organization does an annual survey, a pulse taking of public opinion in Afghanistan, covering all the provinces. The numbers have not been going in a good direction, but that's a pretty good general. You get a pretty good general sense of the pulse of feeling about the state from people, and that tells you whether you're going in the wrong direction on legitimacy, and whether you're winning that hearts and minds struggle, which is absolutely critical. Those numbers are worthwhile.
Yeah. Stephen, did you want to come back in on this? Okay. So we're getting near the end, and it sounds like we should address the other wrap-up question. And, from a purely U.S. political side, there would be the question, what do you think we're going to be doing in November of the next presidential election here? Is this going to still be an important part of the discussion? That's just throwing out one question. I mean, the whole other one is there an exit? Is that exit in 50 years? And I'm just trying to think about, again, not holding your feet to the fire with respect to measurement, but, what are we aiming for here?
I think if you look at the Obama administration, something is clear, which is that it's obvious. The administration's success and failure is going to depend on what happens domestically and with the economy. The best that you can hope for in Afghanistan and Iraq is some kind of decent situation where things haven't blown up, levels of violence are still at a kind of reasonable level, and American troops are stabilizing or going down. Obama, despite what you see in kind of the public face, and I know that he's in Europe now, he will have to spend the vast majority of his time on domestic issues. The president he has the same 24 hours in a day that we do. Every time he flies out to Ohio or California to sell a domestic program, that's an opportunity cost in terms of what he's going to be doing on the international side. He will not and cannot spend that much time on international issues. And the fact is, the best that he can hope for is something that's reasonable, not great. You know, the problem for the administration is if something really tanks, if Afghanistan falls apart, if Iraq breaks up into civil war, that would be costly for the administration, obviously.
Thank you. Neil?
I think, as Steve implied in his last comment, a lot depends on Iraq. That is, the surge worked, but will the surge, the success of the surge, be sustained? That is, will Iraq continue to be relatively self-governing without the influence of the U.S. military? And therefore, will the U.S. be able to commit the kinds of resources that President Obama felt should have been committed to Afghanistan in the first place? Will we then be able to take the resources that are now devoted to Iraq, transfer them to Afghanistan, and sustain the war and bring the war in Afghanistan to a successful conclusion? Many people argue against the expansion of the war or the commitment of larger forces to Afghanistan as one more effort of an empire to suppress and control the Afghan people. I think the U.S. engagement in Afghanistan is quite different from the Soviet experience and quite different from the British experience, because we are not there by dint of our desire to control Afghanistan. We're there in response to attacks that took place by parts by people who are living within Afghanistan who are not endemic to Afghanistan, who bring a different agenda than what the Afghan people want. And I think, by and large, if security can be established and then security maintained by Afghan police and Afghan army, the U.S. will be able to withdraw, because essentially the Afghan people are not, in my view, are not interested in fomenting attacks against the United States. They are interested in returning to the life they had back in the days of King Zahir Shah, where they were not being attacked by foreign bodies, whether it's the Soviet army in the 70s, in the 80s, or by a fundamentalist organization called the Taliban in the 90s, as well as the civil war forces, nor by al-Qaeda. I think they would like to return to Afghanistan for Afghans, and that if we commit the resources and create this, a stable situation, that they will be able to carry that forward. So in 4 years, I think we will be in the right direction, but probably not done with that task. But I'm optimistic that we'll be very much going in the right direction with the current commitment.
Thanks. Bill.
I might foresee three campaign issues. The first one's going to be, why are we still struggling in Afghanistan and Pakistan with much the same questions that we're asking today? Second thing is going to be, who lost Pashtunistan? The focus is on AFPAC, is on Afghanistan and Pakistan, but that strip of Pashtunistan, which is actually beginning to emerge in a way, not as a state, but as a
Both
sides of the border, but primarily on the Pakistan side of the border. You know, who lost that is going to be, and who's responsible for that. And the third thing, as I was talking about before, I think it's unfortunately possible that somebody may be, one of the campaign issues may be, why didn't you foresee that disastrous nonlinear event that has thrown everything else in disarray and has cost us so much? Because inherently, that disastrous event is not really foreseeable.
Yeah. Thank you. One last question came in that I'm just going to throw out here, and it's not really to – I think it answers itself. But one of the students wrote in and saying, if a possible metric might be the percentage and absolute number of girls being educated in these countries, whether that is a relevant measurement factor.
I'll take that, because I spend part of my time focusing on exactly that. We spend a lot of time and effort on gender equality, often under an Islamic context, looking at Islamic principles as a basis for gender equality. Often, the problem is, and I'll stick my neck out here on this. The problem is that probably the most contentious thing for believing jihadis, believing militants, the most contentious cultural issue has to do with gender equality. It's absolutely essential. It's important to us. We're morally committed to it. But would we pursue a war on the other side of the world to advance it. That's obviously not the major issue, but the question really becomes, if we're going to bring in large numbers of Taliban, and it requires that we back off on some of the rights and equality issues that we're so committed to, are we willing to do that? And that's a tough question.
Well, thank you. I want to thank everyone in the audience.
Could I just add one point on that? Yeah. Before the Taliban took control in Afghanistan, girls were educated. After the Taliban came in, they eliminated schools for girls. So I think this is a very acute point, that would be a very good measure for whether or not the return to Afghanistan, defined by Afghans, a metric for that will be whether or not girls' schools are open. And I think I would be positive on that. And I think that's a very acute comment from whoever made it, that would, to me, represent that Afghanistan is back in the hands of the Afghans, not in the hands of fundamentalists whose views are essentially alien to the core principles and values of the Afghans on the ground.
Thank you, Neil. And I want to thank you, the audience, for posing, bringing up these questions and participating with us. And on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I'd like to thank Steve Krasner, Neil Jock, and Bill Cole for sharing their insights today. We'll now take a break. We'll reconvene in 1.5 hour in the lunch in the Grand Ballroom, where our keynote speaker, Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, will deliver his address on U.S. strategic power in the 21st century. Thank you.